from Los Angeles, Marilyn S., and would you please join me in welcoming her.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Slater, and I'm an alcoholic. Really happy to be here in Portland from Los Angeles. And I am grateful to Chris for the invitation to come back here and talk to this group. This is one of my favorite groups. There's so much enthusiasm, and it's wonderful to see some old friends and meet some new ones, and I'm grateful to Chris and Barbara, Dave, and Ann for their hospitality. And I just want to move here and stay forever. But I will go back to Los Angeles and take a lot of happy memories. What brings me here? Well, you can probably guess. I used to drink. But it's a funny thing that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous for what I hope is the last time, February 8, 1972. And when I came in, I didn't, even at that time, after attempting to, visiting the program, should I say, dropping in on the program since 1969, even then I did not think that I was really an alcoholic. I knew something was dreadfully wrong, but it couldn't be that simple. And so I had grave doubts, and I thought I was just kind of passing. Now you say, well, all right, then why did you go to Alcoholics Anonymous? Well, other people wanted me to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't understand why. It could be that the reason they suggested Alcoholics Anonymous was that I had lost my job, lost the ability to work 5 or 6 years before that, and now I was doing very little except drinking every day. That could have been the clue that made them suggest Alcoholics Anonymous, but I just didn't see it because I saw that I had one friend left in the world, and that was alcohol. But I knew I had to cut back a little bit. So here I was in this fellowship, and I was not terribly happy, but there was a big difference. Something happened in 1972 that had never happened before. I had come to the program, I had resisted the program, and I had looked around and judged the program, had a lot of scorn for what I saw. And yet, in 1972, something happened. I heard a person speak at the meeting that I was brought back to, and she told my story. And in my alcoholic fog, I was able to listen to it and realize that she had the kind of fear that I had. She had she talked about a man that she was no longer married to. And she said that she was so fiercely dependent on him, and yet she didn't even like him too much at that time. But she described him as walking around the kitchen and dragging her along on the kitchen floor, holding onto his ankles. And I thought, yes, I recognize that picture. And and I just thought, I can't let her get away. And so after the meeting, I ran up to the podium, and actually I dropped to the floor and grabbed her ankles and said, don't ever leave me, don't ever leave me. And would you be my sponsor? And she agreed to do that. But she demanded something that I considered a terrible, terrible thing at that time. She said, now I'm going to circle some meetings for you. And she circled the meetings of this great big active group in West Los Angeles, the Pacific Group. Yes, some of you have heard. And I had visited that group in my little visits into Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was because I would go to a nice, dark, quiet meeting, and somebody would take my hand and say, Marilyn, you're pretty intense. We know a group that's just right for you. And here I would be in this big, active group with, well, kind of like this group, actually, with a lot of light and people asking questions like, what's your name? And very intrusive. So I explained to her that I am a scientist and I need quiet intellectual meetings. And she said, well, this is Los Angeles. There are hundreds of meetings each night in the greater Los Angeles area. So I'm sure that you can find a program that's just right for you. But of course, I can't be your sponsor. But I had already formed a deep love relationship with Marion, which for me was a sick and hideous dependency, parasitic in nature, in fact. So that parasitic nature led me to do something that was quite good. I said, okay, Marion, even that. I will do that if that's what it takes for you to be my sponsor, because I had already attached. And you would think that having this fierce need to attach to other people, to want their approval so desperately, sounds like a character defect. And yet it was used for something really good in my case. In fact, I've come to believe that whatever we bring into this program, and often it's not much, I came in after quite a few years of garage drinking and had very little to lay at the doorstep of Alcoholics Anonymous, but what I believe was that everything that I brought in was used for something good once I became willing. And this need for approval was certainly used, because I wanted Marion to approve of me, and I began to do the things she asked me to do just to get her to approve of me. Still thinking, I'm passing. I wonder how long they'll let me stay here. I know that there's something wrong with me, and maybe I can cut back on my drinking, and maybe I can get something out of this fellowship, but it's not quite what I need, because I'm not an alcoholic. That was what I knew, really, in the core of my being. And yet I wanted Marion's approval. So I came early to meetings, and I said, Marion, I don't really want to do that. And she said, but we all do that. We come a half an hour early. And I said, but I'm not a social person. I'm pretty much of a loner, and people really don't take to me. Well, do it anyway. Now, I showed up a half an hour early, and she said, now go over and talk to these people. And there was a little threesome. And I walked over, and I said, hi, I'm a scientist. I could have predicted what they were going to do. They just turned and sort of eased away and formed other threesomes. And I was glad, because I could go to Marion and say, see, I'll never fit in here. I can't come early. They don't like me, and they're never going to talk to me. And Marion said, all right, now I want you to go up to this little group, and I want you to first say your name and tell them how long you've been sober. Try that. So I walked up to another threesome and said, I'm Marilyn, and I've been sober for 5 days. And much to my surprise, they turned toward me this time. And they asked me another question. Do you have a sponsor? And now I could say, yes, it's Marion. And they said, oh, yes, she's wonderful. And by that time, I could even tell them I was a scientist. And they just kept saying, keep coming back. It does get better. And I began to trust Marion, that somehow she knew what I could do to begin to fit in here. I didn't like it too much, but I was following along, and I did love those pats on the head, Marion saying, you're doing a good job, Marilyn. So when I was about 30 days sober, I walked into our home group, the Big Pacific group. It was meeting on Tuesday nights in those days at a little place in Los Angeles that held about 275 people. And in those days, the fire marshals didn't arrest people for packing in like sardines. So a at least 300 would stuff themselves in and sit all over the place on rafters and benches and tables. And so as I walked into that big meeting, Marion's husband was standing in a secretary, and she said, and he said, Marilyn, why don't you be a 10-minute speaker tonight? And I said, oh, no, I couldn't do that. I'm fairly new. And Byron just nodded his head and smiled and said, I'd like for you to go talk with your sponsor about that. And I was more than happy to do that because I knew that she would back me up. She would protect me. I had come to believe that she loved me and thought about me every waking moment, and as I did her. And I ran over to her and I explained the situation, and much to my surprise, she looked disappointed and she said, oh, Marilyn, that's an AA request. We always say yes to AA requests. Now, what I'd like for you to do is go back to the door and talk to Byron and say, I've reconsidered. I would love to be a 10-minute speaker. Thank you for the privilege of participating in my own sobriety. Now, I didn't know much about Alcoholics Anonymous, but that line, what an order, I can't go through with it, began to resonate in my brain. But I did it because I so desperately wanted Marion's approval. And Byron just smiled and said, thank you for reconsidering. So I just sat quaking in my boots, and I did not like public speaking, I'll tell you. I didn't even like to talk to a person one-on-one, let alone get up in that big mob. But I thought, I want Marion's approval, and she said to do it. So I also remembered that we are called upon to be rigorously honest. Our chances are less than average unless we're rigorously honest. And I thought, I must search my innermost soul and be honest. And I did that. I thought about myself during the first talk. They called my name, and I got up. And I was as honest as I could possibly be. I talked about the things that were important to me. I talked about growing up in Ohio and experiencing a lot of unhappiness there, a lot of injustice. People really didn't understand me, and they were not kind to me. I talked about a lot of bad breaks and misunderstandings. I talked about suspecting that there is no God, even in the state of Ohio, where there are many religious institutions, and studying science and having that confirmed, knowing that the laws of... I told them that the laws of physics, chemistry, and biology can explain the universe as it is, and it's very elegant, and you need not have a supernatural being. And in fact, anybody who invokes such a thing really is showing a sign of weakness, and that the program would be better if it didn't have this aspect. I just talked about the years of pain leading to a lot of existential angst and deep and hideous depression, and that the longer that life lasted for me, the more intense the pain grew, and then I'd return to existential angst. Then I'd talk a little bit more about the nature of the universe, and then, of course, return to existential angst. I got a signal that time was just about up, and so I thought, well, I've got to end this up on some kind of an interesting and up note, so I said that after a lot of consideration, I have decided that the universe is just one big, hideous wind-up toy. Thank you very much, and I sat down. And that was as honest as I could be. I shared things that I had never shared with anybody before. And at the coffee break, I ran up to Marianne, and how was it? How did I do? And Marion said, it was good that you said yes to AA. But you're going to have to start mentioning that you drank. And I listened to that and I thought, what is she saying? I was as honest as I could be. And drinking has almost nothing to do with the pain that I feel, my true nature. But I wanted Marion's approval so desperately that I began to talk to people about my drinking, whether they wanted to hear about it or not. And if I was ever called to participate, I talked about my drinking. Now, I'm not sure that that helped anyone or even entertained anybody, but what it did was one of the most important things that ever happened to me. It allowed me to put my life in the context of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. It allowed me to look at those instances in my life where I did run into alcohol. And lo and behold, I began to realize that I sounded like other people. I remembered my first drink. I had a toothache when I was about 8 years old. Now, that was a long time ago in Ohio. These days, a mother would take their child to the dentist. But back there in Ohio, my mother said, the Ohio remedy is this. I'll fill up this little cotton ball with scotch, and I want you to hold it on your tooth. And I did that, and I sucked that cotton ball dry and asked for a refill. And she left the bottle of scotch in my room. And I enjoyed my toothache all night long. And that was my first encounter with alcohol. And it was the first time that I just relaxed in this cold and cruel world. This world of existential angst. And it was wonderful, but it did not occur to me that I could find more bottles of scotch. I just kind of forgot about it after that and went on suffering in Ohio. Now, looking back on that time, it's a funny thing that I just spent all of my time trying to get people to like me, trying to make myself happy, and it just wasn't working out. Many, many years later, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I came to see that I had it kind of backwards, that a life lived for my own happiness is the one life that's guaranteed to make me absolutely miserable. But I didn't know that at the time. I thought that if I spend all my time giving you what you want, trying to be what you wanted me to be, just like me, please like me, that's a life that is guaranteed to give me the illusion that nobody likes me. Even if you act like you like me, I will tell myself, but you don't really mean it. But I didn't know that. I was just kind of wandering through life, growing ever more miserable. And then when I was 12 years old, I had another respite. I went with my mom to a party. She worked for the Air Force at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And we went to the officers' club, and as I walked into the room, there was this wonderful fragrance that said to me, cotton ball. This room was clearly filled with non-alcoholics because they had left mixed drinks in half-empty glasses, just lost them, just left them on tables and walked away. So I began to drink those abandoned glasses. And I had my first blackout, and that was nice. I came out of it, and I was out in some bushes with my mother's boss, a colonel in the Air Force, and he was groping and pawing, and I was looking up at him saying, this is the happiest moment of my life, all 12 years of it. And then I don't remember what happened after that. I guess the next blackout, that was good. And then I came out of it, and I was back inside the officers' club, and this time I was pawing and groping the colonel. And he was looking really nervous and trying to explain to his wife that he didn't know what this child was doing. And then coming out of the next blackout in the back seat of the car, singing at the top of my lungs, and my mother was weeping silently in the front seat driving us home, saying, "Those terrible people got my sweet little daughter drunk." And that was a good night. That was nice. But then, as I said, I just was not clever enough to figure out that every day could be like that officer's club. I just kept looking for that thing that was finally going to make me happy. I studied science, and that was a thing that I could kind of escape into, and that became a kind of higher power for me. And what's a higher power? Well, I mean, on the program, it gives us a reason for being. It provides, takes care of all the needs that we have, gives us a sense of purpose, gives us a place in the universe. And I saw that science might do that for me. If I could go away and study it, it could give me a language that would allow, it might allow me to talk to other people. I just never could do that. People would say weird things like, "How are you?" And I would wonder, what are they asking? I'd try to tell them. I suffer a lot of existential angst. I have many suicidal depressions, and they would run away, of course, and think, what do they want? What do they want? And so I just kind of bumbled through life, but I did go away, began to study science, and met a scientist, went to get a job, and I thought, things are going to get better. He was tall and very pale, looked like he had been in a lab all of his life, maybe a library, and he had a slide rule in his pocket. Now, many of you are young. A slide rule is an old-fashioned calculator. That's the way we used to do arithmetic, and I just looked at that slide rule, and it just kind of spelled science with all capital letters. I wanted to grab and fondle his slide rule. I got the job, and after a few weeks, I did. I really thought that somehow things are going to be different. I'm finally going to find that happiness that eluded me. And Bill offered a lot of promise. He went off to Washington, and he sent me a postcard. And I have that postcard to this day in a little velvet box upstairs. And I keep it just because I like to look at it and think, I'm not making this up. But anyway, he sent me a postcard from Washington. He had to go to a meeting there. And he wrote, "Dear Marilyn, I thought about what we were talking about, but all I can come up with is..." And then he wrote out this elegant partial differential equation. And I just thought, oh my gosh, no man has ever talked to me like that before. And one day he said, "Do you want to get married?" And I said, "Yes, yes." And we went off to Ohio, and by that time I was a confirmed atheist, of course, having studied science and given up on God back in Ohio. But his dad was a Lutheran minister, of all things. So here we were in this quaint little church and this religious ceremony, and his dad was saying things like, "For better, for worse, in sickness and in health, richer or poor, till death do you part." And Bill said, "I do." And he believes in keeping commitments. He's a noble kind of guy. And he had absolutely no idea what he was agreeing to. And I heard those very same words, and I said, "Yes, I do. But what I meant was, now I can attach to you like a tick on a dog and drain out your life." And I proceeded to do so. Mm-hmm. After a couple of weeks, talk about relativity and the hypergeometric function began to get a little bit thin. And we got into a hideous argument about the nature of gravitational forces, I remember. And Bill put me to shame because he clearly knew a lot about physics than I did. And so I thought, I'm going to punish him by not talking to him. So I stopped talking to him for a couple of years. And that really threw me into a depression because he seemed to get happier. So now I understand why. We moved to California, and by that time we both were trying to be scientists. He took a job as a scientist, and I was a graduate student working on a research project, feeling crazier and more miserable as time went by, because I just thought this thing that was going to be what changed my life, finally made me a happy person, that wasn't it. But we were entering the 60s, and that was a good time. If you're an alcoholic and you miss the 60s, that's too bad, because that was a good time for alcoholics and people like us. My work was not going well, and I was feeling kind of bad. But as I said, we entered the 60s, and that was good for many reasons. But two big reasons were that there were a lot of protests, and there was a lot of wine. And I liked both of those things. By that time, I'd built up a lot of resentment and a protest. Now, I was not sure what I was protesting, but there were many protests in the 60s. At one point, they nearly closed the University of California down. I guess they did. And there were protests all over the place. And I could carry a sign. I could beat people and things with my sign. And march and get out that resentment. And then after the protest, we'd always retire to somebody's pad. That was an apartment. And that was wonderful. The lights were low, and there was quaint music and wonderful fragrances in the air and candles burning, a lot of wine, and big wine with big and like bases of lamps. And we'd drink the wine, and then when the bottle was empty, we'd stick a candle in it, and then it would melt down the side and look real pretty. And there was always something soft to sit on. Actually, that was other people that had gotten there first, it seemed. But this was my time. And I just thought, I knew that science would one day bring me happiness. And here I was. I just felt like I have found my people. And I was getting out all this resentment and those evenings after the protest were so delicious that I realized how I could improve my work, and that was by taking wine and beer into the lab. Now, that was not a problem because this was the 60s, and you could get away with many things in the 60s. I loved beer by that time, and I imported about 17 cases of beer into the lab at all times and stored it in a big refrigerator, and I was working on muscle protein, the nature of muscle protein, and so I had to redesign my experiments around muscle protein at low temperatures, of course, and so I could do all my work in this big refrigerator near my beloved beer, and I just felt like my work is going so well now. Finally, I have hit my stride in science, and the Nobel Prize is just, it's oh, so close. And one day, actually about 3 years passed, I think, and the director asked me, as I was putting on the parka to go into the refrigerator, what I'd been doing in the refrigerator, and I'd better write up what I'd been doing. I had been supported by grant money and university funds and NIH funds. These days, it's much more difficult to get grants, and you have to justify them, and you have to do some work. And it's a good thing. And so at that time, I just had such a sense of entitlement that somehow the world owes me this. I should be able to do anything with this money. And what I did with it was buy beer and drink it and mix a lot of reagents together and break a lot of glassware and cause some fairly exciting explosions. So the director was kind of pressing me to write up what I'd been doing, and I tried to think of what I'd been doing, and I had no idea. That seemed to be the end of my career. Now, I don't think I would ever have noticed that pattern had Marion not suggested that I talk about my drinking. I began to see that, wow, if I had known what I know now, just by putting my story in the context of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would say that this is an alcoholic right here that we're dealing with, somebody that is out of a job because of drinking. Never occurred to me that alcohol had anything to do with it at all. I just thought more bad breaks, more misunderstandings. And I went home and fairly quickly retired to my garage where I could give myself over to serious drinking. It started out, I think, as a geographic, but there was a refrigerator in the garage, so I filled it with beer and thought I'd plan my trip by sitting there and drinking it, and never got out of the garage. Actually, I did get out of the garage, but I must have been in the house because our house was filling up with little children, and they seemed to be mine, and I did not know how that was happening. I certainly couldn't stop it from happening, and my husband certainly noticed that things had gone to hell in a handbasket. And one day when I was in the house, I noticed that one of them was very, very large, and that turned out to be my mother-in-law. She'd been there for some time, and then she'd disappear and my mother would show up. And that was orchestrated by my husband, who was taking care of the children. He had to go to work every day. And that was the best thing that he could do, was to bring somebody in to make sure that the children were safe and taken care of. And I began to resent these few adults left in my life. I resented them terribly for usurping my place. Actually, they were protecting the children. And they, I think, probably regarded me as, well, like you would think of a mangy animal that wanders into the backyard. If you're a kindly soul, you might put out food for it, but you'd say to it, don't come in the house. They seemed to be happy that I just stayed out in the garage. But I just sat there bewildered. How is this happening? How did it go so terribly wrong? And I had studied science, as I said. I'd been in the university. And I had remembered a few things. One thing was that I remembered was that the unanalyzed life is not worth living. So I analyzed my life. And I thought, if I can just figure it all out, I'm going to get it all together, and then I'm going to bust out of the garage and make my mark on the world. And so I would analyze it and study it. Now, what I should have realized was that the unlived life is not worth analyzing. I just kind of had it backwards. But it was these few adults that began to talk to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. They had heard of this organization for people that seemed to act like I did. And that's what I thought was so irrelevant. Why are they saying things like that to me? As I said, they wanted to take my one friend away. But I began to visit the fellowship. And then nothing worked until that fateful day in 1972. Now, I had seen Marion from afar. And when I was taken back by a 12-stepper, she was the main speaker at that meeting. And that is what began the journey. And Marion's direction to me to talk about my drinking gave me a story. It allowed me to see that I'm pretty much of a, well, I used to think I'm a garden variety alcoholic, but when I talked Now and then people would come up to me and say, you really went pretty far down the track on that train, didn't you? You're kind of a bad alcoholic. And I thought, how wonderful. They believe that I am an alcoholic. And as I talked more about my drinking, as I saw that pattern, it convinced me. I became convinced that, my gosh, that's what's wrong with me. Now, it was good for a couple of reasons. One was that I knew that I belonged here. The other reason was that I began to believe that if I'm an alcoholic and if I do these things that Marianne and other people suggest, then what happened to them might happen to me too. I began to have some kind of hope. For a long time, though, I felt really bad. And as I said, I mean, just mixing with other people alone was painful and hideous. But again, there was Marianne to the rescue. I finally summoned enough courage one time to say, Marianne, what in the world do you say if somebody says, how are you? And she just looked at me. Actually, she laughed. That was often her response to anything I said. She said, Marilyn, most people just regard that as a form of greeting. All you have to do is say, fine, how are you? And I thought, it can't be that simple. But she said, try it. Just go over there. And sure enough, somebody sprang that question. How are you? And I said, fine, how are you? And it was a person named Judy. She began talking. And talking. And I thought, my gosh, we're in a conversation. And I was looking around and thinking, they probably think I'm a normal person now. I'm in a conversation with another person. And I could hardly wait to run back to Marianne to drop to the floor and grab her, the hem of her skirt, and say, it worked, Marianne, it worked, it worked. We were in a conversation. And Marianne said, that's wonderful. What did she say? And a little panic ran through my heart. I said, I don't know. I was thinking about myself. Marianne gave me a lot of words like self-obsession. She then increased the lesson. It was, now, I want you to go back, and this time I want you to listen. And then she'd give me little quizzes. She'd say, now, did you find out about Judy? Does she have a job? Is she married? Does she have a family? How long has she been sober? Does she have a sponsor? And I felt like, I've got to take notes. She asked me about speakers. Wanting Marianne's approval, I started listening. Much to my surprise, I began to hear things that were so much more interesting than anything in my own mind. Other alcoholics would go into a blackout, and they would come out of a blackout in Singapore or on a ship with three masts flying a pirate flag. And I'd come out of a blackout, and I'd be in my garage day after day after day. I used to think a lot about how bad I felt, and I felt bad about many things. I felt bad about the children. I felt bad about not knowing Bill. I felt bad about the way I'd left my job. I talked to Marianne. I talked to other old-timers about that. What do I do about my children? I feel so guilty. I was probably a danger to them. I was at best an absentee mom. And they'd say things like, well, do you work with newcomers? And I'd think, well, that's not what I'm asking. Have you written an inventory? I'm not asking about inventories. I'm asking about my children. How do I drop this guilt that I feel? How do I feel better about them? And they just didn't have an answer for me. I'd ask, will I ever go back to work again? And people would say, well, do you have a job at this meeting? And I'd say, no, not that kind of job. I mean, paycheck, resume. How can I ever go back to work again? I just I squandered the university funds. I was a disgrace. I don't know how I can write a resume. And I would stammer and I'd beg them to tell me. And they'd say, well, volunteer for Southern California Convention. And I'd think, you don't know what I'm asking. And again, they'd bring up inventory. Have you written an inventory? Have you made amends, they'd say. So finally, I got so desperate. And I needed to do what my classmates were doing. I don't know whether you do that up here, but we have classes. Like, I'm class of 1972 because I got sober in 1972. And my classmates were all writing inventories. And so I sat down one day at Marion's encouragement, and I wrote a searching and fearless moral inventory of my mother-in-law. And much to my surprise, she listened to it from beginning to end, and she then said, now, we're just going to consider something that you obviously are not acquainted with, and that is your part, Marilyn. And she began to coach me on my part. I had no idea what she was talking about, but I began to understand. I also began to see that there are some things that I might have done differently. And we finally got onto the topic of amends. And I said, okay, I'll write a letter of amends to my mother-in-law. And Marion said, wonderful. Let me read it before you mail it. And after 17 revisions, I was able to mail one. I thought to myself, how can I send such a letter to my mother-in-law? This will give her so much power. She already thinks I'm terrible. And I was afraid of her, and I didn't like her very much. And I just saw the power that this would give to her for me to admit things that I had done wrong. So I sent off the letter anyway, wanting Marion's approval more than anything else in the world. Much to my great surprise, my mother-in-law wrote to me, and she thanked me for my letter. And she said, you can't imagine how long I have wanted to get a letter like this from you, because I've wanted to say to you that I am so sorry, too. I'm sorry for any part that I played. And she wrote about herself, and she wrote about her desire to have a good relationship with us so that she would get to know her grandchildren better. And in the end, she said, let's hope that this is just the beginning of many wonderful years together. And I thought, this is amazing. She is kind. And she doesn't seem to want to punish me. My family's like that. They always treated me like a broken machine. If you can't fix it, work around it. And yet I saw them in my drinking days as being so mean and so cruel. A lot of people talk about our perceptions changing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And with the amends step, they certainly began to change. I had to write about 3 major inventories before I could really get to my part in anything and the damage that I'd caused other people. And how I had essentially stolen from NIH and the university by squandering all that money. And I had to make an appointment with the director of the lab and go back and ask him how could I begin to make up for this terrible behavior in the lab. And he just acted kind of embarrassed and put his hand on the doorknob, and I took that as a sign that I was supposed to go out that door. And I walked out in the hall, and I thought, that felt terrible. We're supposed to feel good after making amends. And I complained to some old-timers, and they said, well, that's the beginning. That's the apology. Now you have to amend your conduct. And I said, but how can I amend my conduct? I don't have a job. I'll never see him again, probably. I'll never go back to work. And they said, you'll go back to work when the time is right. There'll be a knock at the door. And I just could not understand how I could make amends in that situation by amending my conduct. And again, they suggested, take a job in every meeting you go to. Do a lot of service in Alcoholics Anonymous and see what happens. I worked with newcomers, because I was told to do that, and that became such an important part of my program. I'm a strong believer in sponsorship because I understand the program more from working with others than anything else that I do. I don't really understand my life and how the program applies in my life until I try to point out how it might apply in a newcomer's life. Much to my surprise, I found myself talking to... Oh, by the way, after I got sober, I counted my children, and there's only three of them. And it just seemed like there were a lot more when I was drinking. And we were growing up together, and the old-timers were right. I found myself talking with them like I was talking with newcomers. Susie, our youngest, had become a teenager by that time. And we were sitting on her bed one night, and she was so sad. And she was talking about her own existential angst. She was talking about wanting to kill herself. She talked about how sad she was because she saw her boyfriend Tom in front of Rocky Horror Picture Show with his arm around Amber. And her little heart was breaking. And I talked about rejection and how I had felt rejected by people for so much of my life and how painful it was. And I said, Susie, if you can just live through tonight and we'll sit here together and we'll talk. And if we can just make it through tonight and you can put some days together, you will come to see that Tom is a jerk. And I'm happy to say that she did that. And I finally found a mate who's not a jerk and walked down the aisle with him and produced two little grandsons. Our son, David, used to steal things. And he seemed to be the one who was the most damaged by his crazy alcoholic mom. He had sort of a nervous tic and trembled a lot. And when he was a little guy, a very helpful person on the program had suggested just sit down with him and don't try to talk him out of stealing. Don't try to do anything, but just sit with him and let him say anything he wants to. And just be supportive of whatever he says. And I began to do that, and yet I worried about his stealing, and people said pray about it, and I was just not sure of this God business, but I prayed about it and nothing happened. But one day when we were just talking, David was beginning to grow up, and he somehow saw a thing that showed some rock climbers, and he said, you know, I'd like to do that. And he was 12 or 13 years old by this time. Still had not found his way and was doing a lot of things that seemed kind of scary to me. I remembered that I used to be a rock climber. The person I was a graduate student with had introduced me to rock climbing. And I used to go out climbing in Southern California until I started drinking a lot of beer, and then I lost my climbing partners. Well, not that way. I mean, I liked to drink when I went out, and they just really didn't want to climb with me. So I thought that requires a little bit too much energy anyway. But I remembered those days and the beginning of that and how much fun it was. And so I said to David, I used to do that, but that's dangerous. So we have to do it carefully. And so I thought, let's sign up in the Sierra Club. They have a rock climbing section. And in those days, it was not such a litigious time. And so there were good rock climbing groups and basic mountaineering. So we signed up for that. And I had to go along with David because he was still a minor. And the Sierra Club required that a parent go along with such a little one. So David and I went off to the Sierra Club and went into basic mountaineering. And I began to climb with David. And he kind of found his thing. He took to rock climbing and other mountaineering. And he's kind of mechanically inclined, like his dad. And he began to grasp this whole idea of putting protection in cracks in rocks and how to handle ropes. And I saw him really getting into that. And when we were kind of evenly matched, he and I were climbing partners, and we climbed with the Sierra Club, and sometimes we went out on our own. And some years, a couple years went by, and I was out on a climb with David out at Taquitz Rock down in Southern California. And it's a nice climb. It's about 500 feet of pretty vertical granite. And David was doing the lead, and he would climb up, and maybe some of you are climbers, but only one person climbs at a time, and the partner bolts him or herself into a rock and then holds the rope and belays the partner. So David was going up, putting in protection, clipping the rope in and climbing ever higher, and Mom was sitting there holding the rope, and I was just thinking, boy, my climbing partners would no longer climb with me. And there was a time when I was sitting in the garage and I couldn't even come in the house because I was a danger to the kids. And now I am holding David's life in my hands with this rope. And he was climbing and he got up to a spot and he bolted himself in and secured himself. And I started climbing with David holding the rope. And I just looked up at my young son who was growing into a fine man and thinking, man, it's been a long time since I worried about David stealing anything. He had a sense of himself, and he still does a lot of rock climbing, but he grew up, and now they're all in their 30s. They're all older than I am because they were born before I got sober. But he became a scientist like his dad, and has a life that is full indeed, just because he grew up under the influence of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's not an alcoholic, but this program, like our drinking, when we're practicing our disease, it goes out and poisons everybody around us. And I believe that recovery does the same kind of thing. It sort of creeps out and seeps out of our pores and influences the people around us. And he grew up with these principles that we know and love in this fellowship. As I said, I just worried about not being able ever to work again. And the kids were clearly getting squared away. And we were growing up together. We'd moved up to San Francisco, and I got a phone call, and it was the director of that old lab where I'd drunk all the beer, the one I'd made amends to and felt pretty embarrassed about and pretty bad about. And he was on the phone down in Los Angeles in the lab and called me in San Francisco and said, Marilyn, there's an interesting position here. Just wondered if you'd like to come back to work. And I almost dropped the phone and I sort of stammered, they said there'd be a knock at the door when the time was right. And he said, knock at the door? You're in San Francisco. I'm in Los Angeles. It was hard enough to get your phone number. But by that time, I was able to say, yes, I would love to come back. So when we moved back to Los Angeles, the time was right, and I went back to work in that lab where I drunk all the beer, and there was an opportunity to make living amends in that place where I drunk the beer. So happily. Now, I had felt horrible about that experience, and yet there were old-timers. And I have, unlike many alcoholics, been surrounded by wholesome people much of my life. I didn't recognize it until I had been sober for quite a few years. But it turns out that wholesome people don't carry a lot of resentments. And they tend to look on people like me as sick people. And I one time, even after I went back that second time, looked in my old personnel file, and I just saw that I had been terminated. And the reason, and the administrative assistant had written sickness. I thought, well, somehow they knew. And these people left over from the old days would say things like, Marilyn, do you remember in the old days that time that at the Christmas party when Tom was trying to throw you into the centrifuge, and I thought, yes, yes, I remember those days. Much to my surprise and sadness, now that I was sober, I still broke glassware and blew up things, and wet science seems not to be for me. But I enjoyed the information. So I went back to school and I studied library and information science and work a lot with computers, and I've worked in that profession ever since and enjoy that very much and seem not to blow up things anymore. And so everybody's happy. As I may have mentioned, in these last years, our two daughters have produced four little grandsons. And I kind of missed that the first time around. When our children were born, I was in outer space somewhere. I just did not hear their first words or see them take their first steps. It was all a big blur as I look back on that time and felt sad about that. I saw beautiful women in Alcoholics Anonymous, like Jane, giving birth to sober babies and just thinking, I wonder, what is that like? These healthy, wonderful babies born in sobriety where moms don't feel guilt about the kinds of things that I felt so much guilt about. What would that be like? Well, I sort of found out what it's like. I was in the room when our little grandsons came into the world, two out of four, and they were all pink and screaming, and I got to hold them shortly after they were born. And we were blessed by all living in Southern California, so I've watched them grow up, and I've seen them take their first steps, and they always say, their first words are something like, ga, ga, which means grandma, I'm sure. And I get to hear that. And and as you probably gathered, our kids took mates of their very own, not jerks, really nice people. And for that first wedding, when our firstborn walked down the aisle, I heard those wedding vows again. And I thought, wow, that is love, isn't it? That we're here for one another. For better or for worse, in sickness and in health. For richer or for poorer. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me that love is commitment. It's being here for one another. It is answering the phone at 3 o'clock in the morning if somebody's in trouble and trying to say, at the right time and stay awake and listen. And it's showing up to make coffee. If I love my meeting, then I show up to make coffee if I'm the coffee maker. If I love Alcoholics Anonymous, I say yes, yes, yes to this fellowship. I've become convinced that recovery takes place because we say yes, just like Marion had told me in the beginning. Began to listen to these vows and understand that love is commitment. And I looked, and Father of the Bride, Bill, was sitting next to me. And if we both live to the 31st of August, we will have celebrated 47 years together. And that attests to the power of the program as much as the fact that it's kept me sober a long time. There's a lot of power here. And I also saw my mother and my mother-in-law sitting there so proud of their granddaughter, who was a beautiful bride. And I'm a self-obsessed alcoholic, of course, and so I thought, you know, these people here, the other people in this room are just looking at us and thinking, that's just one big happy family. If only they knew. They could never have guessed, but I knew. This program has given me a second chance at life. In the beginning, I was miserable and thought I never did get just what I always wanted. I never did get it. And you'd say, well, what is that? And I'd say, I don't know. I just know I never got it. But this transformation occurs in this fellowship. And I've been aware lately that this program has given me that present. Just what I always wanted, it's given it to me. And you'd say, what is it? And I would say, I don't know. I just know that I got it. Thank you.